I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The Butler Does It. Again, Charles McPherson wrote a bestseller a couple of years ago, The Butler Speaks, and this time he's got a new book with more advice, more tasteful tips to help us get through every situation. The book is called The Pocket Butler, A Compact Guide to Modern Manners, Business Etiquette, and Everyday Entertaining. Charles McPherson joins me now. I'll get him to tell us about this book. It's replete with sage advice from someone who worked as a butler for more than 26 years. He's also the founder of Charles McPherson Associates, North America's only registered school for butlers and household managers. He's a regular on the Marilyn Dennis Show and has written for the National Post and Metro. His website is at charlesmcpherson.com. The book is published by Appetite, which is an imprint of Random House. Please welcome to the Plant Online program from here in Vancouver today, Charles McPherson. Mr. McPherson, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good. Yourself?
I'm great, thank you.
So what I liked about this book is that it isn't rigid. I mean, there are rules, but they can be adjusted to any situation, and the book is really accessible. I mean, was that the point when you were writing it?
I'm so excited to hear that you say that you didn't find it rigid, because I think that is absolutely one of the points that I wanted to make very clearly in my book, is that etiquette is, you know, I believe, a living, breathing document with us, you know, as society moves and changes. And so I don't think it should ever be something that's rigid and makes us feel uncomfortable, but it, in fact, should help you feel comfortable. So I'm really pleased to hear you say that you got that from the book.
Yeah. Do you find that in Canada, in the United States, I guess in North America, that there's a desire for knowing what the quote-unquote rules are, you know?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, when we look at how from where we've come from the 1960s, where etiquette was really kind of, you know, laughed at and ridiculed and people pushed away from it, that we've really come back to realizing that, you know, we actually enjoy etiquette to a certain extent, because it's really not just for rich or for snobby people. Etiquette is really about how do we interact with each other every day. And when we know the simple rules of how do you shake someone's hand correctly, or how do you make an introduction, or which fork do you use at the dinner table, it makes you feel comfortable and build self-confidence. And that's what etiquette is really all about, is building your self-confidence to put others at ease.
Yeah, people are interested in decorum. They don't want to stick their foot in it.
Exactly. And yet they don't want to be so restrictive that, you know, we go back to the Victorian era where there was a rule for every single thing.
Yeah, even in the book, I mean, in talking about evolution, you have a small part in the book about fist bumping. I mean, that's something new. We didn't do that, say, 20 years ago.
No, we didn't. And you know, that is, you know, a very famous Canadian who taught us how to fist bump, which is Howie Mandel.
Correct, yeah. He was concerned about germs, though, I think.
For him, he's a germaphobe, absolutely. But I think that just your point about how there's that point in the book about fist bumping is, I think that just shows how, you know, good etiquette changes with the time, and that's what this is all about.
So Charles McPherson Associates, that's, the only registered school in North America, is that correct?
It is, and so we're very proud of that not only is it in Canada,
yeah,
but that is the only recognized school, absolutely.
How many people go through the program?
So what I like about it is that the classes are small. So the maximum class size is 12 people, and right now there's 3 classes per year.
What sort of folks come to you? Are they young people hoping that this is their career, or are they, say, older folks who've probably done this sort of work in the past, say?
No, it's an interesting question. And so what's interesting is that the younger students who come to us traditionally don't do as well of people who are in, you know, a midlife, you know, career change. And so, you know, usually once you're in your 40s, you have some life experience behind you, so that when you go to Butler School and when you graduate, you traditionally really succeed very well because of that experience.
And you'll pardon the question, but who uses a butler nowadays? I mean, is this a certain class, certain demographic of people?
So, you know, although it may be a certain group of people, but, you know, there's even, you know, high-end, you know, double-income-earning families that are using a butler to be able to do the grocery shopping, pick up the kids from school, take them to hockey lessons, and be able to, you know, able to put their skates on and get them organized and out the door. So, you know, it's not just, you know, an upper-class you know, society, but it's also, you know, double income earners that are using the advantages and of what a butler can do for them.
And a butler, is that generally a male, and then a household manager, would that be a female, say?
So that's interesting, but no. So butlers in households traditionally tend to be male by 90%, and there's about 10% female. In the hotel industry, they tend to be about 50-50. But the term household manager tends to be more a word that is exactly the same thing as a butler, but it tends to be more North American, where we tend to be more comfortable with the term house manager versus the term butler. You know, that the term butler is still very European. Mm. And, you know, we all have these images of bees, you know, in our mind, and we think, oh, I don't want that in my house. But when you say a household manager, you know, who may just be dressed, you know, in a pair of, you know, dress slacks and a shirt, you know, without a tie or anything like that, it makes them, you know, people much more comfortable in North America.
And you spent 26 years as a butler, is that right?
Almost, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I worked for a very famous Canadian family that your listeners all know and love.
Yeah, and so that was your whole time you spent with them, is that right?
Exactly.
Yeah, and I guess Downton Abbey's Carson, I guess he's the most conspicuous butler in our culture nowadays. What do you make of, say, his portrayal and how fans of the show have regarded him and his work?
So I love Mr. Carson, and I love the show Downton Abbey. You know, it's done very well, and the attention to detail is really great. Although I caution people that it's still a soap opera, you know, it's a really great show. And, you know, they have someone on the set called an orator who is there to make sure that all the attention to detail is still observed. And, you know, I would be very proud, you know, not only to know Mr. Carson as a working butler, but, you know, to work under him or with him.
And he does seem like a snob, though. And I mean, is that something that's a prerequisite for that line of work in that era, say?
Yeah. So I would respectfully disagree. I don't think he's a snob. I think he's more reserved. And I think that's the role of a good butler, is someone who's just really reserved.
But he tends to look down at people. I mean, when you see him with Mrs. Hughes, she sort of chides him for being a little more snobbish than, say, even the Crawleys.
Yeah. So, you know what, I'll give you that. I think you're right. I think that's a very good point. And once in a while, that, you know, she needs to kind of pull him along. But, I think, you know, sometimes, you know, what he's trying to do, I think, is really hold a standard. I think that's really, you know, more what he cares about, and he's passionate about doing something correctly, rather than, I think, just being a snob.
But he's not an indiscreet snob like the Cinderby butler that we saw in the last episode, Stoll. I mean, that guy was just a piece of work, wasn't he?
Yes, no, exactly. And, you know, at the end of the day, he actually, what I love about him is that he truly cares. And so, you know, you see him at one point when he goes to Lady Mary, and he may say something, you know, to her that is not, you know, necessarily appropriate, but it's because he really cares about her and the family that he permits himself to say something, and then she gets a little grumpy with him, but then she kind of comes back and,
right,
you know what, you were right, and thank you for that. And so that's what I love about him, is that he's honest and sincere, and that he's well-intentioned versus just about appearances.
Now, the Americans have had their own contribution, I guess, to say how we view butlers. I mean, the butler on Batman, say. I went to the Vanderbilt Mansion last month in Hyde Park, and it's a huge house, obviously, and I guess that place needed butlers and the sort. How have Americans, say, in the 20th century, how have they sort of appropriated the use of the butler, and, say, did they, when you teach your students now at Charles McPherson Associates, are there any American influences to the work?
So there are American influences. And so, you know, when the butlers really came to America from England, it was really about, you know, in the United States there isn't a class system. And so it was a way that people were able to elevate themselves and to show their financial status. Where today, it's not so much about financial status, but today the butler or the household manager in the United States is really more about lifestyle and being able to, you know, clients that have multiple residences, that have numerous amounts of staff, that the butler becomes the one point of contact, as opposed to the employer having to speak to every employee individually. So it's about making it more efficient, the way you would run a business. And so I think that, you know, what the Americans have brought to Butler's is that they've and I say respectfully, taken the formality down a little bit, but still give them huge amounts of respect for their skill sets and for what they can do.
And in terms of some of the pieces of advice that you give us in this book, and it's extremely useful. I mean, when you look at the book, you might think that, well, you know, I don't have any use for a butler, can't afford a butler. But there are things in it that are just extremely useful, that the book is good for everybody. Well, one of the things is we've already touched on fist bumping, but shaking one's hand. We all have to do that as we grow up in life, and what have you noticed in terms of how we do it wrong?
So I love your observations. And so quite often what we do wrong is we do what's called the wet fish, where you just kind of give your fingers to someone, and so it makes it kind of uncomfortable. Or you do the bone crusher, where you're shaking someone's hand and you're squeezing so hard that it becomes uncomfortable for the other person. And so I think that, to your point, you know, being able to use these kinds of skills from the book, for example, how do you shake someone's hand correctly? So you extend the hand, it's web to web, the amount of pressure that you use to hold a water bottle, a plastic water bottle, then you shake three or four times and release on the fourth time. If you learn these kinds of things, these skill sets can actually help you succeed in your career in today's world. Because, you know, if you're going for a job interview and there's two of you and you both have the same education and same skill set, it's the education of how do you introduce someone correctly? How do you shake someone's hand? And how do you have lunch, you know, with your boss or a client that can really make the difference between you and the other candidate? And so that's what I love about this, is that it's not something for just rich or snobby people, as I say, but it's something that each and every one of us can use to our advantage to succeed in business.
And in shaking hands, are you a fan of, say, when you've got the other person's hand, you put your other hand clutching the one hand?
So I'm not, and that's called the political handshake. And so the reason that that's not done is because it's considered insincere. And so people are discouraged. We discourage people from doing that. And because then, you want the handshake to be sincere and not have it misinterpreted.
How about grabbing the elbow with the other hand?
So, no, again, it's the same thing. It's that insincerity.
Yeah, yeah. Calculating tips, I mean, we all like to go out and eat. Do you find that we're not tipping enough, say?
I think we either under-tip or over-tip, and we always kind of stress about it. And then, you know, there's certain parts of the world where you don't tip at all, and so, you know, you don't want to embarrass yourself. I remember the first time that I was in Japan, and I was in Tokyo, and I went to tip the bellman, as we do in North America and in Europe, and I was embarrassed because I was, you know, then told by the manager and the bellman that's inappropriate, that you're not supposed to do that in Japan. And so that's one of the reasons I wanted to put that tipping chart in the book, is to help us, for those of us that travel around the world, that we don't put ourselves in those awkward positions.
Yeah, you have what the customs are in, say, North America as opposed to Asia, the different parts of Asia, obviously, because they've got different customs in different countries there. And then, of course, in Europe, what we do if we're there.
Exactly, and also to help give you a guide on how much you should tip. But, you know, a tip is really a reward for good service. And so even though there's a guide of percentages, just to try to help give you a guideline of where you might want to be, you know, if someone gives you bad service, you should never hesitate to not feeling obligated to give a gratuity. That's your choice. And if someone does something really above and beyond, you know, you may choose to reward them a little bit more than the suggested numbers.
And so have you, when you've gone places, given nothing for a tip if the service was crap?
Oh, absolutely. And I make a point of explaining why I'm not leaving a tip.
I see.
You know, if I was with a client having lunch and it was bad service, that's not the time to do it. But if I'm with my family, if I'm by myself, or just my best friend, and, you know, the service was particularly bad, I think that it's important to say why you're not going to leave a tip, so that someone just doesn't think that you're just being rude.
And the other thing that you do in the book, there's a great section in it with sort of illustrations, which I think is very helpful, is a section on notes. We don't write notes enough, whether they're notes of thanks, notes of congratulations, notes of condolences. You're a big proponent of that.
I am, because I think that they're so impactful. And so, you know, in the perfect world, you know, when you can send a note by mail, you know, we so rarely now get stuff in the mail that when you get something in the mail, it's really impactful. But I think, as I've said earlier, etiquette also has to be a living, breathing document that can move and change with our time. And so email is a common form of written communication above amongst us today. So I think that there's nothing wrong with using an email for a thank you note, but you can't write a one line saying, hey, thanks for dinner, exclamation mark. That's not a proper note. And so, you know, to be able to say, you know, dear Aunt Mary, you know, thank you very much for that wonderful, you know, dinner that you served on Saturday night. We really had a good time. You know, I've always loved that Jell-O mold recipe. You know, looking forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks. That becomes a proper note. So as long as you're going to write it properly, whether it's on a card or in an email, it's absolutely acceptable. Because, you know, someone has gone to the trouble of doing something for you. They may have spent money and time. And so, you know, everyone loves to be thanked. And you'll never make a mistake by sending a proper note. You'll always make a mistake by never sending a note.
Exactly. And if you are sending a note, say, on paper, or you're mailing it, it doesn't hurt to have, say, proper stationery to do that. And you're seeing less and less of that nowadays, aren't you?
You are. And, you know, in a perfect world, wouldn't it be great if we all kind of still had stationery with our name on it and stuff like that?
Yeah.
That I don't think is necessarily realistic for most of us. And so just the fact that, you know, you can just go to, you know, your local drugstore or a paper store, paper goods store, whatever, and just buying a few, you know, a box of a few really nice thank you cards is still really great if you're going to send a hand. So don't be intimidated that it has to be, you know, printed stationery. Again, I think what's more important is not necessarily the stationery, but the fact that you've gone to the trouble to write the note and you've written the note properly. That's what the person's going to really appreciate.
Yeah. What I've done is I've bought, say, watermarked paper, you know, thick watermarked paper, and I just take it home and then I put my name on the top with my printer at home, and then I use that.
Great idea, and that's a great way to do things.
Yeah. Is there a reason when one should be fashionably late?
You know what? I don't really believe so. I think that, you know, it kind of throws the timing off for things when you're fashionably late. You know, but always giving just a, you know, if you're called to be at someone's house for 7, showing up early is never good because sometimes the host or the hostess isn't really ready.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, giving them, you know, 10, 15 minutes just kind of helps them, you know, kind of in case they're running a few minutes behind to catch up.
Yeah.
But after that, it just becomes late, and then it, you know, makes it difficult for everybody else.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was a time not too long ago. I mean it's probably still part of our culture where being late seemed to be de rigueur. I mean, the people,
exactly.
You know, and I guess in the book you tell us that say being late says something about us.
It does, and you know, sadly, what it says, you know, is if you've gone to the trouble to invite me to your house. Or to an event or to a wedding, doesn't matter what it is. And, you know, if I show up, you know, an hour or two late, it really says to you, I really wasn't interested in coming, but, you know, I forced myself to be here versus, you know, giving you just an extra 10 minutes to come in 10, 15 minutes late just in case you're running behind.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're going to run behind, because, you know, sometimes something happens, you get caught, you're stuck at the office, you're in traffic, you know, your car may be right down, whatever it is, then just call and just say you're running behind and keep the host or the hostess informed. And that, you know, then it's being polite.
We're seeing a lot of people going back to hosting guests over for brunch or tea, even dinner, certainly. There's a lot of practical advice in your book, Charles, for the sort of flatware, the dishes that we ought to have on hand, even the bar, what we need to keep stocked if we're having people over. Yeah. Did you find that there's an increase in say North America for people, you know, trying to make their table settings the way it should be, say?
I think that what's happened is that, you know, we're not necessarily setting our tables in the formal way that we used to, you know, 50 or 100 years ago with all the sets of dishes. But the point of that part of the book is just to kind of give you an idea. And what I find people are doing is as you say, they're starting to enjoy entertaining at home again, but it's in a more casual style. But it's, so it's starting to think about, well, what do I need? Do I need, you know, all those, you know, vegetable-covered dishes and meat dishes of the past,
or can I do things a little bit differently? So it kind of just gives you the options of what's out there. And, you know, as things become more casual, then the dishes change accordingly. But people are definitely interested in knowing what they should be buying, and more importantly, what they can use and what can go in the dishwasher and make their life simpler.
This book really, Charles, is for everyone, isn't it?
You know what? I love that you say that, and I think that it's, you know, whether you're graduating from college or university or high school and you're going into your first job to help you have self-confidence, or if you're older and just want to be able to have a great little reference book, you know, The Pocket Butler, I think, is that perfect little book that's not intimidating. It's Charles the Butler, your friend, who I'm not trying to tell you what to do, but I'm rather trying to share with you my experiences as a butler of what I've seen and what I've seen people and how what makes them successful, and just kind of share that with you in the book.
Yeah, we all want to be polite. We want to be tasteful. We want to be confident, and we don't want to be flustered. And that applies everywhere in life, doesn't it?
Exactly. And, you know, again, no matter where you go in the world, if you kind of keep those things in mind, you're always welcome.
Charles, as I said, it's a very useful book to have around. Good luck with it. Thanks for your time today. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. It's been an honor to be with you and your listeners.
The website for more, charlesmcpherson.com. The book is called The Pocket Butler, A Compact Guide to Modern Manners, Business Etiquette, and Everyday Entertaining. It's from Appetite, which is an imprint of Random House. Its author, Charles McPherson, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.